This is Ryan here for The Scale Up Show. I have Mark Roberge on. If you don't know him, he was the original chief revenue officer at HubSpot, is actually a legend in the go-to-market space, is now on the venture capital side, but is doing some amazing things. We go deep on the opportunities with specifically AI companies, what's happening in the market, how to exploit it, take advantage of what companies you want to work for or be a part of on the go-to-market side. He's done tons of research on it. So I love his perspective because it's truly unique. And he shares some stuff that I've never heard him share publicly before. And so look forward to having you on the episode, but check it out. How do you grow like a VC-backed company without taking on investors? Do you want to create a lifestyle business, a performance business, or an empire? How do you scale to an exit without losing your freedom? Those are the questions, and this show is the answer. I have Mark Roberge. Mark needs no introduction, but he is the author of the Sales Acceleration Formula. On top of it, he's an advisor to HubSpot. He was also the former chief revenue officer at HubSpot sales division, helping him go from zero to 100 million. He's also HubSpot Academy inbound sales certification instructor, which is a mouthful, lecturer at Harvard as well. Does a bunch of other cool stuff. Mark, welcome. Happy to have you on the show, man.
Hey, thanks, Ryan.
I'm trying to get through like the bio. It's like you got so many different
Don't
things
bother.
We could hit on. Right.
Don't bother, yeah.
But hey, I'm happy to have you on the show, man. I love, you know, what you've put out. You've gone down the route of obviously progressing from a CRO to some what some people would say the dark side, right? As a venture capitalist now, right?
For sure. I kind of feel that way.
Do you? Do you feel
definitely? I come from I did a couple startups and I raised money. I was founder of one. And, you know, it was back in the early 2000s where we were just transitioning from when venture capitalists, the only differentiator you need was having money. And some of them were pretty egotistical about it. And I just had a lot of meetings where it was like, they weren't even like paying attention to you. You just felt like scum.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, there's a little like bad perception, I suppose, there. And I honestly never thought I'd become a venture capitalist, but it just so happened that the mission of Stage 2, we can talk about later, fell right in the bullseye of my first principle of the value I want to create in the ecosystem where I feel like I'm supposed to create. So anyway, yeah, I agree with you.
Well, what's the bullseye? You can't tease us, man. You can't leave us
hanging. Oh, just like, you know, I'm a passionate entrepreneur. I've been one since 23. I had this like, I mean, I guess just to tell you, I don't know when you went to undergrad, but like I went there in the mid late 90s and entrepreneurship wasn't a thing. Like it really didn't become a big thing until like the late 90s with the dot-com boom and bust. Like there wasn't a single entrepreneurship class that was offered. None of my peers were saying we're going to start a company. It was like a thing that like rich board people did. And then like, you know, I was a year out, I was writing code for Accenture and they stabbed me in a startup and I was like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. And I never looked back. Love entrepreneurship. In fact, I consider myself more of an entrepreneur than a sales leader. And I just so happened to like fall into the realm of go-to-market and sales and marketing and was blessed with this wonderful ride at HubSpot and this knowledge and experience. So that's it. That's my first principle is, you know, all the time I spend working, I want to maximize my impact on the startup ecosystem using this gift of go-to-market expertise. And that's what led me to Harvard. What a platform to do that.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what led to the co-founding of Stage 2 Capital, thanks to my co-founder Jay's vision on what that could be. So that's how I became a venture capitalist. Never really intended to be.
That's a cool story, man. And I graduated around the same time as you. I think late 90s is when I was an undergrad. Mm-hmm. And you're right. It was like rich board people started companies. You know, the email thing was just kind of. Email was just getting launched like when I was in college. I'm like, what's this? You could use this to talk to women. This is amazing, right? Like that was like
it looked like a DOS interface.
Oh, it's terrible.
It was so weird, you know?
It was debacle, right? But that was anyways. So I get what you're talking about because it was the same thing. Like after that, like I didn't get a taste of startups till later, much, much later than you do. But I always worked for companies that were startup like environments. Where they were just like, go make it happen. Like no resources or infrastructure, just go make it happen, right? So cool. I could relate to that. So that's really cool, man. And then you started off coding, you developed, progressed, CRO, you know, entrepreneur and then on to the funding side, which I think your mission's cool because you, it's basically by operators for operators. It's kind of, not to oversimplify it, but that's the way I
Yeah, specific to go to market. Yeah. You know, 600 of what we think are the best CROs, CMOs out there from Snowflake and, you know, Atlassian, Salesforce, et cetera. Yeah. So, you know.
So let's shift gears a little bit, man. You know, I love just your perspective and view of the market when we did on the pre-show call. And I know you've been looking at, based on the fact that you're an investor, the whole AI company ecosystem and what's going on there. So like if you're looking at this and this is for you, the listener, right? Like how would you identify like what are good AI companies either to invest in, to work for, or just actually good AI companies, because there's so many that have gotten rolled out over the last 12 months. So we'd love to hear your perspective on that.
Oh, for sure. Thank you, Ron. I want you to hear this because you've been doing it too. And I want to like exchange notes and I want you to challenge me and all that stuff.
Yeah, so, let's do it, man. Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, let's do it. So like, I think I'd imagine that like, I don't know, of the audience out there, maybe like 60 or 70% or more like go-to-market operators that, you know, this is super relevant for, because I think, I mean, I've never had more conviction for my students that come up to me like, hey, professor, like what should I do? Like, I want to go into startups. Like, what should I do? And I've always had like different opinions. I mean, you have to go to AI. Mm-hmm. Like every tech company is going to, in like 6 years, is going to be native AI. You have to get that experience now. So if you're an operator, you know, I think this will maybe be an interesting preamble to like help you pick your future employer. I think there's some people out there listening, 20, 30% that are maybe founders. And I think this will help you orient your business around it. And then maybe there's like 5 or 10% angel investors and we can exchange notes. But bottom line is like, this is critical. I do think that I agree with the sentiment out there that this is a generational technology. It's on par with the entrance of the internet, you know, 25 years ago. I think it's much bigger than that actually societally.
Agreed.
And I think it's really, you can learn a lot by drawing analogs to how the internet rolled out and the Gartner hype cycle. You know, I agree with the sentiment that we're in a massive hype cycle right now. I think all the tea leaves are similar to like 1997. Let's not forget that in that time, we dialed up to the internet using AOL, launched a Netscape browser and did searches through AltaVista, right? Where are those companies?
Lycos, right?
Is OpenAI Netscape or is it Google? Like we got to figure that out, right? And so I think most of them are like Netscapes and not Googles and Salesforce and Snowflakes. So like, you know, I think there's just in the beginning of the hype cycle, it's really hard to visualize what the capabilities of the technology is. Like we thought the internet was putting your company brochure online and the news online. We couldn't visualize Snowflake and Twilio and Uber and all the things that it became. And I think that's where we are now. Like, I think, the majority of ideas out there are simply like latch-ons of basic AI technology into an existing workflow. They're not a reimagining of the workflow. Mm-hmm. I think they're going to get completely disrupted. And yeah, I think they're raising money with no product and no revenue at $200 million valuations. And that's the same thing that happened in 1999. And it just busted. And then we had this like storm, this winter storm for 2 years. And then like the real businesses grew, you know, and we figured this thing out. And now like, what is it? Of the top 10 most valuable companies in the world, I think 6 or 7 were born in the post-internet era. Of the top 50 most valuable B2B software companies in the world, 42 of them were built in the post, you know, internet era. The let's not forget that in 1995, I think 80% of the CRM market was owned by Siebel and Act.
Yeah.
Raise your hand if you use Siebel and Act.
I use Act.
Right? So it's like
terrible.
Yeah, I mean, but today do you use them, right? So it's like, it's hard for people to be like, oh, there's no way. There's no way these, like, I'm looking at the top 50 B2Bs. You can't take them down. No, I mean, maybe for the first time in history, but like with every generational technology, it's really hard for them to defend. And so that's been like the riddle is, well, how do we do this? I'm just looking at it from an investor, but you have to ask the same thing as a potential employer. As an employer, your journey is easier because it's just like, it's very simple. Just join an AI company. There's a 90% chance it will fail. It doesn't matter. You're going to get AI experience before everybody else. And you're going to get scooped up with the ultimate winner.
Yeah.
Like join whoever. And it's like, the future Google is going to scoop you up because you won't, there are not a lot of people have eggs. That's easy. Just join an AI company. But for me, I got to put my $5 million bet somewhere and I lose. So the whole premise there is like, okay, we're in a hype cycle. Be careful. I do think in 5 years, 90% of our investments will be AI. I think in the next year, 10 to 20% will be.
Okay.
And so like I got to look for places to stack the deck in my favor. And clearly given the background of myself and my partners, given like the focus of the firm, given that we are backed by 600 CROs, CMOs, CCOs, our expertise is the go-to-market tech stack, the sales tech stack, the MarTech stack, which is surprisingly an area that we've done very little investing in. Because like, you know, for every Gone and Outreach and Sales Loft that broke through the billion-dollar barrier, there were like 50,000 that tried because the current incumbents are very hard. Like if you're going to be like create in like VC caliber returns in like sales tech, you eventually have to take on Salesforce and HubSpot. And that's like really hard. And we've just shied away from it. But we think that with the AI, you know, technology landscape, it rewrites the landscape, you know? So like I went out to learn and I was like, okay, folks, last year I was like, well, I stood up at like our LP meeting and I said, you're all CROs of public companies. Like I bet you are being asked by the street to do more with less. I bet you're being asked by your boards to do more with less.
Yep.
I bet AI is a part of that story, that strategy. So we are looking at a ton of go-to-market AI startups. If you want to see what we're seeing to try them in your organization to see if they create that do more with less opportunity, send me a note. I got 110 emails from all these great companies. And I went online in May and I was like, hey, I have the CRO of all these huge software companies that want to test new go-to-market tech. Mm-hmm. So if you're building go-to-market AI tech, email me. We got 250 applications in 3 weeks.
Wow.
Boring stuff. Like SDR co-pilots, like auto marketing, collateral writing, like 50, like the same old companies. And I was like, all right, whatever. We sifted through it. And every Monday and Thursday, we promoted four of them to the CROs. And I don't know, we did that for like 8 weeks. And I think there were 80 meetings that got set up. Two pilots, no rollouts. Really? And I was like, dude, I was like, what the heck? I thought we were going to do. I thought we were going to like find one and make them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I went back to the CROs and I'm like, what's going on? And they were like, yeah, we loved it. It's just legal and IT shut us down.
They're too small, right?
They were like, we don't have an AI policy.
Hello, this is Ryan here. Real quick, if you are enjoying this episode, please hit the subscribe button and leave a comment or review. If you want more help or just want to learn more about what the top SaaS CEOs and founders are doing, check out my website at www.ryanstaley.io. Join my newsletter, check out other free content resources I have there, and let me know if you want to scale your business. Now back to the episode.
I've been like helping companies roll this out, like as we've talked about. And here's where I think I'm starting to see cracks in the universe when it comes to the whole security thing is, and this is based on huge moats, which I think is a problem for OpenAI. It's basically Copilot and Workspace, having it embedded in there because there's a commercial data protection guarantee. And they have all the entire stack of, you know, basically PowerPoint, Excel, all those users on Office 365, and then same on Workspace. And it negates all that security stuff because it's already
in the environment. I totally agree.
You know what I mean?
I totally agree. And it doesn't help me as an investor. And I don't think it helps an employee trying to find the next Google in this technical area. Because I think that's brilliant, Ryan. And I like want to learn more about that. And it's kind of in line with what I've been seeing, which is the AI technology that's going to create significant operational efficiency and growth this year and next for companies, especially these bigger companies that my CROs are from, is not going to be the trillion-dollar new company that disrupts the space. Like, and I think that's where the opportunity is like, because just to like finish the dialogue there, once those large companies told me that like legal and IT are blocking, mm-hmm. it's like, okay, cool. Like, I get it. They're just going to wait to see what Salesforce and Microsoft and everyone latches on. That makes total sense. It's safe, right? But like, that doesn't help me to figure out who's going to replace everyone, which happened in every other tech. And maybe this is the first tech like move that it doesn't happen, but I don't see a lot of evidence of that. And so like, I was just like, this is great for us. Cause all this means that like the big incumbents are going to like close the door on huge operational efficiencies that startups can take advantage of and mm-hmm. just accelerate the disruption that they already can create. So I went back to our portfolio and I was like, hey, let's start implementing these things. And we've started to see some glimpses of stuff, but that's like helped me understand, Ryan, to your point of like, even in our startup portfolio, I think the AI technology that's going to help them most in the next year is not going to be the AI technology that redefines the CRM sector, the marketing sector over the next 10 years. So that's what I'm kind of like wrestling with a little bit. And I'll put like one more idea in your head to like bring that to life. What's been interesting about that journey with the startups is I've kind of come to the conclusion that the AI companies, vendors, technology that is going to create the most operational efficiency, even for our startups in the next year, is not going to be the same AI technology company, et cetera, that becomes the disruptor over the next decade and redefines the sales and MarTech sector. And so like, this is a moment of innovator's dilemma and of appropriate beachhead selection. So let me just unpack those two concepts and then Ryan, you can like throw up all over it because you've been staring at this actually more than I have on the practitioner side. So like innovator's dilemma, Clay Christensen, he argues with each of these like new technology eras, mm-hmm. the incumbents are at a disadvantage because the initial opportunity size is small and the investment necessary to get there is big. And so I think there's a perfect parallel with Siebel as the internet came about. So Siebel's sitting there, owns most of the market share in CRM, on-premise software. And they're like, shoot, this internet thing's coming out. Should we do anything? Maybe they hired McKinsey. Maybe McKinsey went out and talked to 1,000 CIOs and came back and said, no, you shouldn't do anything. And they were like, why? And like, well, we talked to 1,000 CIOs and all of them said they would never put their data in the cloud. They don't trust it. And second, we evaluated what it would take to replatform your on-prem software to cloud-based and it cost you $1 billion. So why would you spend $1 billion to go after a small market? Boom, classic innovator's dilemma. Yep. And Benioff like leaves Oracle, does Salesforce, like exploits the SMB sector where they don't care about these security items. And before you know it, everybody wants to be in the cloud for the technology architecture efficiencies and he's there to catch it and Siebel isn't, right? So what's the innovator's dilemma today? I don't know, but maybe it's that like all these sales tech companies are seat-based and the promise of AI is to get rid of the seats. Maybe. Like maybe if like there's an engineer at a CRM company and they were like, hey, I'm going to build software to get rid of all the SDRs. Can the CRM really do that? Like if $2 billion of their revenue was based on SDR seats, can they afford to build software to get rid of that?
Yeah.
How do they protect themselves? And like if a greenfield, you know, sales tech company came out with an AI first mentality and wasn't seat based and could charge like 1/10 of what it costs for today's CRM. How could today's CRM ever defend against? I don't know. I don't know if that's like the innovator's dilemma. So that's point number one. Point number two is the beachhead strategy. Because whatever your vision is on how this stuff works in 5 or 6 years, the market's not ready for it, nor is the tech. And so the best example, but what we have to do is have that vision and build the assets to capture it. And so the best, most classic example of that is Bezos and Amazon. Like 1996, Bezos, a quant hedge fund trader, and he quits. He didn't quit to become a book salesman. He quit because he thought everyone would buy everything online from food to apparel to furniture, everything, right? But the market wasn't ready. No one trusted it. So what he did was he basically said, what is the market ready for that will allow me to create the sustainable moat to capture the long-term vision when the market's ready. The market was ready for books. He listed 50 products and books was number one because there's 50 million SKUs. You can buy it online. A book's a book. There's no question on quality. And it's pretty profitable, actually. Good profit margin. So he does that. And in the meantime, he's building a decentralized warehouse footprint in cheap areas of the country with a delivery mechanism so that when people are ready to buy furniture and clothes, et cetera, online, he's there to catch it and Walmart's not. Right. So that's kind of the question. If you are starting a business or joining a business, what is that problem set? How is it going to be solved in a post-AI world 5 or 10 years from now? What are the sustainable assets you can build today to go after that? And what revenue can you create to build those assets so you win the long-term game? I don't know, Ryan.
I've given a lot of thought to that. And I'm not going to say publicly what my answer is on this, but I will share something else that I see. So, which is related. I think, well, first of all, awesome breakdown, dude. Loved it. Love the Bezos, you know, breakdown, because it's so true. Like, he's not like, oh, I'm going to go from quant hedge funds to sell books. Like, it's just, that's not it. So obviously he was looking at the long game and he always has. What I see, and I was curious on your take on this, man, of like, you know, just like Wayne Gretzky always used to say, where the puck's going, not where it's at right now.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, if you look at the stacks, this is the kind of the way I look at like the AI environment. And this is not as macro as you. I mean, in terms of like, well, let me break it down. So step one, I look at the whole innovator's dilemma as basically Perplexity and Google right now. Like, Google didn't want to disrupt their $80 billion ad market that they had from pay-per-click and everything else. So Perplexity just created a much better, basically, search engine so that you don't have to deal with all the crap and ads and just blue links and everything that they have to go through. And they're starting to eat their lunch, right? And then at the same time, they didn't want to give away the AI because they had so much money invested in it. And then that's when OpenAI took them. So they're getting hit on multiple angles, right? But if we go more on the Bezos side, where this is where I see, if you look at like the foundation, like I think, and this gets trivialized, but I think prompting is so critical of a foundation because it's the source code of basically the language of the AI moving forward. And AI doesn't operate, as you know, like basically SaaS, where it's the same process consistently. It's got jagged edges of things it does really well and things that it sucks at that you think it would do well at, right? So by understanding that domain expertise and integrating that in the prompts, that's the foundation. Step two is what you're starting to see already with GPTs, where there's like micro workflows. And then the next step is agents. Obviously, agents are being developed and those are still just okay in their development phase, which GPTs are as well. What's going to happen is like 5 to 10 years from now, there's going to be swarms of agents where basically you'll have whole departments or companies that are 10 times the power of Apple that have the capability to operate autonomously and then with human oversight. And that's actually what one of the founders of OpenAI said he could see happening down the road. So that's where I think the puck's going if we're looking at it from that perspective. And that's what I talk about with all my clients to take it from
tech-assisted
to autonomous.
I totally agree. And I'll let you continue your question or comment on that. But like, I don't think what we're saying is different. There's just different strategies around it in terms of like formulating a good business model and, you know, how the tech stack evolves. Like the way one way I say it that I think is very similar to what you're seeing is, you know, in the last 10 or 15 years, let's just stay in our domain, Ryan, of like go to market.
Yeah.
Like RevOps has become like huge. It didn't even exist 15 years ago. And for the most part, RevOps is seen as an organization that supports the humans to do their job. And that flips with what you're saying is at some point it flips where RevOps does the job and humans there to tweak it. And we're starting to see that a little bit more. And that gets us away from the co-pilot where the incumbents, I feel like, need to lean to the displacement. Like it's driven by AI where the that's just running and then humans are there to just tweak and refine it.
Yeah.
But I think that's kind of what you're saying to somebody, you know?
Totally, man. I think that's a good summarization. Like, and if you use like the data analysis tool on ChatGPT at all? Have you used that?
Yeah.
I had a chance to use it. So that's a prime example of what you're talking about, right?
Exactly.
Like you could literally have a data scientist. It's buggy sometimes, right? It's not perfect, but you could glean. There's insights that used to take me 8 hours to do and go to market manually that I can now do in like 15 minutes on that thing, right? Yeah. So I don't know.
It definitely helps you see the promise. You know, like I kind of feel like we got to see beyond like, there's so many issues, like the hallucinations, the latencies on responses, the, you know, the synchronous parallel conversations, the, like the data analysis clunkiness, like those all feel like things that just get ironed out as the tech, what, like we talked about, the tech matures. I mean, remember dialing up through AOL, remember?
Oh yeah.
You know, like
the dot matrix. You know,
remember the first, like, yeah, it's just like, college, right, exactly. You know? So I kind of feel like that stuff will get ironed out, and then you could start to see, I think, you know, ChatGPT helped to see what this could really be.
Exactly, man. Well, let's wrap it up here for now, because we're going to do a part two, and we went way longer than I expected, but I guess that's awesome conversation. I'll do that too. So just for those, if you haven't found Mark online yet or haven't seen his stuff, Mark, where can people find you? Where can they learn more about you if they want to learn more about you or Stage Two?
Yeah, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, you know, and like you could see my writing in Stage Two's writing there. You know, just so you, I think you've heard through the episode, we're the first VC firm running back by what we think are the most successful sales and marketing and customer success and ops, go-to-market ops leaders in the world. And we're here to help the next generation of entrepreneurs with their visions and businesses by supporting with go-to-market excellence. So you can find me on LinkedIn and Stage Two.
Excellent, man. Well, awesome. Love this discussion we have for part one. Part two, we're going to get more into looking at like AI native companies versus adapted companies. How does go to market fit in? How do you grow a company? What to look at for distribution? So do not miss the next episode. But Mark, it was awesome doing part one with you, and I'm looking forward to the next one, man.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you for checking out the Scale Up Show. My mission in life is to help founders and revenue leaders avoid all the pain and suffering in revenue growth so they can flip it and create a life of their own design. So if you enjoyed this show, please like, review, share it on social, and more importantly, just share it with a friend. Share it with someone that you think could learn and benefit from what you heard on today. But the more we get the message out, the more people we could help, the bigger the impact we make, and the bigger the community gets, which helps everybody. So once again, thank you for being a loyal listener. I appreciate you and look forward to seeing you on the next episode.